We have an ongoing debate in this country about the proper regulation of drugs. And, of course, we say this from a pair of states where marijuana is now legal for personal recreational use. But even outside our region, there's a constant tension between people who think the war on drugs failed and people who think that war needs to be stepped up. A libertarian named Ross Ulbricht thought drug regulation was ridiculous. If people want to take drugs, they should be allowed to, is his position. So he set up the website Silk Road, trafficking drugs all over the world. The story is told in the book American Kingpin, the epic hunt for the criminal mastermind behind the Silk Road. Nick Bilton is a special correspondent for Vanity Fair and a contributor at CNBC. Nick was a columnist of the New York Times for nearly 10 years, and his previous book, Hatching Twitter, landed on the Times bestseller list. Nick Bilton, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on the show.
So for someone who writes about tech, I'm guessing this story must have been nearly irresistible to you.
Well, yeah, but I actually didn't start writing it because of the tech angle or anything like that. I lived in San Francisco from around 2011 to 2014, and I lived in a little sleepy part of the city called Glen Park, which is where all the firefighters and teachers and folks lived. And I used to walk my dog every day past this tiny little library that looked like the size of a shoe store. Mm-hmm. And I always wondered who would go to that library. And it turned out the guy who was running the biggest drug empire in the world was working out of there in the same coffee shops I worked out of, which was just completely fascinating to me.
That is pretty wild. I mean, the fact that you could run a drug empire from a laptop computer and not much else. I mean, as we'll learn more about Ross Ulbricht, this is not a guy who believed in lots of creature comforts. And by the way, once we get into the book, I was not at all surprised to see that you laid out a cast of characters for us. And it seems like it gets about four people deep before we finally get the one without an alias. So everybody seemed to operate in some sort of avatar mode on the internet.
Yeah, it's there's the book is structured in a way where you kind of go from one chapter from Ross's perspective to another from someone else's perspective, whether it's law enforcement or his employees. And he very quickly after he starts the site, starts hiring people all over the world who are working for him, hackers, anti-government folks, drug dealers, so on. And they, of course, go by these incredibly fantastic aliases like Variety Jones and same, but different. And Ross himself eventually becomes the alias of the Dread Pirate Roberts as he runs the website.
Well, I'm glad you, by the second scene in the book, you feature a Homeland Security agent who asks a question a lot of us ask. What's Silk Road?
Yeah, so the Homeland Security agent, his name is Jared Yeagan. In the beginning of the book, we open up with this one moment that I think was probably one of the most fascinating for me was there's this pink pill that they discover in the mail at the Chicago O'Hare Airport. And just to put the perspective of a tiny pink pill into perspective, I visited the airport and I went to where the mail comes in. And what happens is mail comes in every single day, millions and millions of pieces of mail from all over the world into all these national airports in the United States, international airports. And when a lot of it is carried on the same planes that we all travel on, and it goes on across the tarmac to this massive mail sorting facility. And the one in Chicago, it looks like it's 10 football fields big, and it's just an insurmountable amount of mail. And these agents they just use their gut for the most part. They grab a piece of mail, they think this looks weird, they put it aside, cut it open. If there's anything in it, they seize it. If there's not, it often goes back into the system. And this customs guy found a piece of mail, thought it looked weird, and opened it, and there was a single pink pill inside. And that led Jared Yeagan to go to the house of the person who was getting the mail, who told him all about this website called the Silk Road, which was what he called the Amazon of drugs, where you could buy and sell drugs. And you could do so on the dark web anonymously, and you paid for things with bitcoins, and the U.S. Postal Service would deliver your drugs to your house.
So this is a whole realm a lot of people don't really know about. I didn't even know that there was a Tor browser until recently. I mean, and this is really about being able to manipulate or navigate on a part of the Internet where nobody knows who you are or where you came from.
Yeah, so the Tor browser was actually, one of the ironies of this whole story is that all of the things that Ross used to build the Silk Road and to sell the drugs that he was trying to, essentially subvert the legal system in the United States, all of those drugs were, all those tools were part of they exist in America. They were built by Americans. So the internet is built by the, you know, U.S., the backbone of it here in the U.S. The Tor browser was built by the U.S. Navy. And the goal with that was when people are overseas, that they could communicate with their loved ones back home and not have to worry about someone, you know, in North Korea or Iraq or something, overhearing what they're saying. And then, of course, the U.S. Postal Service is originally designed just to send mail and postcards and things like that. And so Ross took advantage of all these things and used them in a very nefarious way. As far as the Tor browser and the dark web goes, there was actually just yesterday, one of the inventors of Tor had put out a statement saying how he no longer works on the project because after the Silk Road, it is now 95% of the Tor browser is used for people selling illegal things. And doing nefarious things on the dark web, and it kind of became the thing he hoped it would not.
So that leads to the next question about whether Silk Road was unique on the dark web, or it sounds like by now it's quite common.
Well, it was unique when it started. It was the first, essentially. You know, people had talked about things like this before. They talked about these ideas of creating what, in one forum post, someone called a heroin store, where you could buy and sell heroin on the internet. But Ross was really a pioneer. He was the one that came up with it. And the thing that's so fascinating is, you know, and I spoke to hundreds of people for the book and went through millions of words of chat logs and diary entries and all these different things. For Ross, he was, you know, he was the sweetest kid you could imagine. He was born in Texas, Austin, Texas. He was a Boy Scout. He was the guy that would stop in the middle of a sentence and help an old lady across the street. And he was incredibly thoughtful. He volunteered, and he ended up going to Penn State for his master's to be a physicist, and got super into libertarian politics. And that led to the creation of the website.
All right, we'll learn a lot more about Ross Ulbricht, who went on the internet as the Dread Pirate Roberts and is the title character of Nick Bilton's book, American Kingpin, The Epic Hunt for the Criminal Mastermind Behind the Silk Road. It was a website where you could buy and sell any kind of drugs, and it got bigger into guns and much more. You'll learn about this as we continue on in our discussion with Nick Bilton, back on the Jefferson Exchange with him and with you in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Nick Bilton, special correspondent for Vanity Fair, contributor at CNBC, author a couple of times over. His latest book is about a man who went from becoming a Boy Scout who helped people across the street to becoming the operator of the largest drug-selling website on the dark web, the Silk Road. This is Ross Ulbricht we're talking about. The book is called American Kingpin, The Epic Hunt for the Criminal Mastermind Behind the Silk Road. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So by all indications of his early life and with some of the wishes he had, certainly until he got to Penn State, Ross Ulbricht sounds like a guy who really would have been pretty happy with the pretty standard-looking American dream.
Well, yeah, I think that was the original goal when he first set out. From high school, he had a girlfriend that he had fallen in love with, and when he went to propose to her, he found out that she had cheated on him with several other people, and I think that was kind of like a turning point in his life where he decided he was going to go down a different route. I'm sure there were other things that played a role in that, but he kind of embodies that. You know, I've been covering Silicon Valley for a long time, and there's a type of person that wants more than just a family. They want legacy. They want to be remembered for something impactful. And I think Ross is one of those personalities. And I think one of the things that's interesting is he read the same Ayn Rand books and had, you know, the same libertarian philosophies and beliefs that people like Travis Kalanick, who run Uber, and Mark Zuckerberg, who runs Facebook, and you know, that the system doesn't work the way it is and that they can come up with a better version of it. And, Ross chose drugs and these other people chose taxis and social media to disrupt. And I think that played a it's so interesting to see that play out over time with all these people. The other thing that's interesting is that Ross, of course, changed over the period of running the website. He started out with very altruistic goals in mind, and he believed that if you legalize drugs, that it would make the world a safer place, that people wouldn't be killed in drug wars and wouldn't have to risk going to jail for buying something that he believed you should be able to take at your own free will. And of course, as the site started to grow and the stakes got bigger, the things he started to do got much less altruistic, I'll say.
So the libertarianism didn't start at Penn State. It actually came from within his family, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Austin is a kind of a little bit of a hotbed for libertarian thinking. Most people just discussed it in coffee shops and at the dinner table, as Ross did with his friends and family. And you know, we all know a Ross Ulbricht that we went to school with that got really into an idea, and inevitably, you know, that person often ends up going and working in the government and trying to have it make a difference there, or you know, working for a startup or something like that, or kind of just letting the concepts and the ideas fall by the wayside. Of course, Ross decided he was going to do something about it. And the website was his version of trying to prove to the world that by legalizing drugs, that you could make it a safer and better place. What happens, though, is, you know, when he first opens up shop, he needs some drugs to sell. So he grows magic mushrooms in this laboratory that he builds. And then people start buying and selling from the site, and other drug dealers start selling on there, and magic mushrooms turns into people selling acid and then cocaine and then heroin. And next thing you know, it's guns and bombs and bomb tools and poisons, and eventually there's discussions of body parts and Uzis and AR-15s, and it just kind of it just goes from there.
We get to know Ross Ulbricht pretty well in American Kingpin through his girlfriend at Penn State, who ended up quitting Penn State and moving with Ross Ulbricht to Austin. That's his Julia, and she's almost like the voice of reason. Of the rest of society, in a sense, the way she's portrayed certainly in the book and probably was in real life as well. But the fact that she's the person saying, well, okay, I get where you're coming from, and I understand that up to this point, but she even reached a point where she could go no further with him.
Yeah, you know, Ross's girlfriend, Julia, was also from Austin. And you know, I actually do agree with a lot of Ross's philosophies, that I do think that, you know, that the war on drugs has not worked. We have hundreds of thousands of people, mostly African-American, Hispanic, that are in jail for selling drugs. You have people that are in jail for buying drugs and consuming them. And you have a lot of people that have been incarcerated for minor drugs, like marijuana and magic mushrooms and things like that. And I think that it's ludicrous that that is part of the system. You know, I was doing some research for the book and looked at the number of people who have died from magic mushrooms over the last 30 years, and there are literally two, and they actually don't even know if those two people died as a result of those drugs or if it was other side effects, that, you know, heart attack or whatever it was. And I think that I agree with that philosophy, but when it comes to things like heroin and fentanyl, which is this version of heroin that's made in these labs in China, I don't think that's a drug. I think that that's a poison. And last year, in 2015, sorry, more people died from overdoses of heroin and fentanyl in the United States than from gun deaths, tens of thousands of people. And so, you know, I don't think that these are, it's not the same argument to say that marijuana should be legal and that heroin and fentanyl should be too.
So you made a point in the book that Ross Ulbricht actually did watch Breaking Bad. What did you think about that?
Well, it's really funny. It's an interesting parallel with Breaking Bad. He ends up, he gets really into Breaking Bad while he's working on the site. He doesn't see them as the same thing. He sees that his concept is something completely different. He sees that Walter White, aka Heisenberg from Breaking Bad, was just trying to get rich, whereas Ross was trying to make a difference in the world. But he is these pretty funny moments where he's literally in his drug lab. He's renting this apartment for like $450 a month outside Austin. He's growing his magic mushrooms, waiting for the gypsum to cure and this, that, and the other. And he's sitting on his laptop watching Breaking Bad. And in the same time, when he is actually apprehended and caught at the end of the book, and that, of course, is not giving away the ending, believe it or not, but he gets caught downloading It's the day after the final episode of Breaking Bad, the last episode, and he gets caught downloading an interview with the creator of the Breaking Bad discussing the final episode. That's where he's caught, in the library near my house.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. So you mentioned is the progression here. So he started actually doing some farming of magic mushrooms so he'd have something to sell as he created Silk Road. How did he come up with the idea for the name?
He came up with the idea for the name. The original name was actually going to be called, I forget the exact name, I think it was like Black Markets Reloaded or something like that. And he went through a few different names, and eventually he came up with the Silk Road, and he actually got it from a lot of the texts he was reading. He was reading these texts about in college about libertarianism and so on. And one of the things that he was reading about was how the Silk Road, the original Silk Road, was the consensus with free marketplace and where people traded things all along from all around the world in this old ancient Asian trade route. And that was where it came from, and it, you know, it was a perfect name as far as he was concerned. There was a lot of, you know, one of the fascinating things is that there was a lot of brilliance in the naming of things. Even Ross Ulbricht's pseudonym, the Dread Pirate Roberts, which comes from the movie The Princess Bride. One of Ross's employees, this guy who went by the name Variety Jones, which is also a brilliant name. Variety Jones came up with the idea that Ross should rename himself the Dread Pirate Roberts, and his theory was that in the original Princess Bride story, the Dread Pirate Roberts would sometimes retire every few years and hand off his mask to someone else who would then become the Dread Pirate Roberts, and that no one would know who had started and who had begun. And the concept was that the Silk Road would go on forever, and that would be the case, that the Dread Pirate Roberts would restart. And it ended up proving to be one of the best things that they ever did on the site, because it was in Ross's entire defense in court that there were multiple Dread Pirate Roberts.
Oh, really? So the same as the movie. You'd make a great Dread Pirate Roberts, that kind of thing. Nick Bilton's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is called American Kingpin, The Epic Hunt for the Criminal Mastermind Behind the Silk Road. Silk Road, in this case, being the website on the dark web that bought and sold or allowed everybody to trade drugs and guns and a whole lot more over time. And Ross Ulbricht was the real Dread Pirate Roberts. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So once other people began to start trading through Silk Road, the part that we still haven't talked about is how they managed to complete the transactions. I mean, it's not like you want to put your credit card onto these websites.
Yeah, you know, what happens is with Bitcoin today, or back then, the same way when you go to an airport, let's say you're going to Europe and you stop at the airport and you go to one of those exchanges and you take your credit card and you say, I want, you know, 100 euro or whatever it is. And they swipe your credit card and then they give you 100 euro. When you come back into the country, you can give them back that euro and they put it back on your card and then give you US dollars. Bitcoin exchanges work in the exact same way. And what happens is the thing that's interesting is the price of Bitcoin. So Bitcoin was created. No one knows who created it. There was somebody called Satoshi Nakamoto, and it's another pseudonym on the dark web. No one owns Bitcoin. There's no bank or website somewhere that owns it. It's just this thing this piece of software that runs online, and everyone who uses it is essentially a part owner of it. And so with Bitcoin, you would go take your credit card, you would go to one of the Bitcoin exchanges, you would say, I want $100 worth of Bitcoin, and then you would take your Bitcoins, you get these kind of series of numbers, and then you would go to the Silk Road and you would buy your drugs, give them an address to mail it to, and then you would then exchange your Bitcoin to back if you had any left over, or that's how you buy your drugs. What's fascinating is the price of Bitcoin over the past few years has skyrocketed. When Ross first began working on the site, there was a dollar or so a Bitcoin, even less. Today, a Bitcoin is worth around $2,200. When Ross was arrested in that public library, he had tens of millions of dollars in Bitcoin on his computer. Had he still been around today and had access to that, it would have been worth hundreds of millions, if not a billion or more.
So the money part is really amazing to me, because it wasn't like it ever made a difference to Ross. I mean, you learn early in the book that he lived very simply, lived rent free in somebody's basement when Julia first met him at Penn State. Hardly had any clothes. Basically had a bag for dirty clothes and a bag for clean clothes, and that was everything he would wear. Had some programming skills, but started the site by himself. He was having some problems, I understand, with the money part early on in the early days of Silk Road.
Yeah, he was, for Ross, I think he wanted the money. I think the money was important to him, but I think at the same time he also wanted to make a difference, and I think he struggled with those two things. He didn't think that they could be you could have one without the other, and I think the interesting thing is the money for him was never really for, as you said, he didn't go shopping. Like it's interesting, after Ross was arrested, there was another Silk Road that popped up immediately after, and a new Dread Pirate Roberts that took over, and they eventually called that guy too. And that guy, he had bought a Tesla, he was living in a fancy apartment, eating at like 5-star restaurants, living the high life of a real deal drug dealer. And for Ross, when he was caught, he was literally wearing the same exact clothes his girlfriend had bought him 5 years earlier in college. I mean, quite literally the same jeans, T-shirt and everything, same backpack. He had $2 in cash in his pocket, and he was living in a $1,200 a month apartment that he was renting off Craigslist. He was paying cash for. His only furniture was some stuff that he bought off the street from a garage sale. He just didn't live lavishly. And he, at the same time he's doing this, he has tens of millions of dollars at his disposal. And so I think for him, the money was important because it was a sign of almost like a video game. It's a sign of how much he had collected. But it was never really about the money as much as in the beginning. It was about the altruistic goal. And I think by the end, it was about the power.
We're talking about Ross Ulbricht, the title character in Nick Bilton's book American Kingpin, The Epic Hunt for the Criminal Mastermind Behind the Silk Road. After a while, there were strains in his relationship with Julia, and also there was more attention to Silk Road over time. There's actually a piece in Gawker about it, and what did that do to his traffic?
So the site, kind of started very slowly. A few people here, a few people there started using it, then more and more. But what happened on June 1st, 2011, incidentally, the exact same day that first pink pill was discovered by the Chicago airport customs officials, at 4:20 p.m., a guy from Gawker posted a story that he had discovered this website where you could buy any drug imaginable, and it exploded from there. I mean, it got picked up by every national news outlet. It was kind of unbelievable that you could buy drugs from the internet and no one would ever get caught. And at the same time, that was when the authorities really started to look at things. So you had Jared Yeagan from the Department of Homeland Security that started looking at the site from a drug and even from a weapons standpoint. He assumed that eventually there would be weapons on the site, and worried that ISIS or Al-Qaeda or something would be able to come in and buy things in the U.S. and use them to do some sort of terrorist attack. And then you had Chuck Schumer, the senator from New York, who was incensed about what this site was and what it was doing. And he ordered the Department of Justice to start looking into it. And over time, as the website started to grow at this rapid pace, the law enforcement officials that started to hunt for him started to grow too. And you, one minute you had no one looking at it, and next thing you had the Department of Homeland Security, DEA, FBI, Department of Justice, Secret Service, mail, postal police, you name it. And then eventually what ends up happening is some of the cops that are hunting down the site end up working for Ross and selling information back to him and doing essentially these fake murders for him.
Wow, it's a really interesting trail here. I want to get into some of the, as I mentioned, Jared Yeagan earlier in the hour. I'm struck by some of the parallels here. It seems like both Jared and Ross were rather single-minded in their approach to life.
Yeah, I think that they, they both wanted to have an impact, of course. And they both, it's interesting when you look at the people involved in the site. I think it's a story. The book itself is really a story about ambition, not necessarily a story about, it is a story about drugs and guns and all these other things and these fake murder for hires and so on. But it's definitely, you know, about people wanting to be ambitious. And Jared and Ross shared one trait that they'd had a series of failures. Jared had tried to get a job. He worked in a movie theater and he really wanted to have an impact and help people and protect people and so on. And he had tried numerous times to get involved in law enforcement. He didn't have a degree from college. And he'd been turned down by pretty much everyone, and eventually got a job in customs that then eventually after many years led to a job for Homeland Security as an agent. And, but it was a long road to get there. And Ross kind of went through the same thing. He had wanted to do something big and important and made a difference in the world. And he everything he tried was a failure, one after the other after the other. And eventually he started the Silk Road, which led to all the things we've been discussing so far today.
Sure. And so it led to this book, American Kingpin, The Epic Hunt for the Criminal Mastermind Behind the Silk Road. Nick Bilton is the author of the book and our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We have a lot more to talk about. There's a lot more interesting twists and turns this story takes, and we're not going to get them all in, I can assure you of that. But we'll come back and talk more about those, take phone calls and emails from you if you have some questions for Nick about Ross Ulbricht and all the other characters and events in the book. Back to talk more about American Kingpin in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Today we're asking the question, how does someone who is a polite and kind young man, a former Boy Scout interested in lots of things with many skills, end up a criminal mastermind operating a website that buys and sells drugs, a website worth hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars? The answer is in the book American Kingpin, The Epic Hunt for the Criminal Mastermind Behind the Silk Road. Nick Bilton, special correspondent for Vanity Fair and contributor at CNBC, is the author of the book and our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. You can join us if you have questions about the process we're talking about here or the personalities as well. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So back to personal relationships, not the business stuff. I mean, there were obviously increasing tensions over time with Julia, who knew what was going on with the website, with Silk Road, and had some objections to what Ross was doing. She spilled the beans at some point about Silk Road to a friend, and how key was that to things that might have happened later on?
Well, there were two things that were key to the things that happened later on. One was that Ross was a self-taught programmer. He essentially taught himself how to code, built the website by himself. The front end, the back end, the design, you name it. He was like the CEO, marketing guy, all of it. If he was a startup, it would have cost, you know, $1 million worth of employees to do what he did. So, you know, he's incredibly smart, but he also hit a few walls here and there. One of them was that he had stumbled into a few problems with programming the site and ended up having to recruit one of his friends who was actually a programmer. The friend stayed on and involved up until that Gawker article came out, and then wanted nothing to do with it because he feared that they would eventually get caught. He ended up becoming someone that testified against Ross in court. But there was also another event which, you know, Ross had to tell someone. He had a really hard time, which is understandable, but he had a really hard time keeping this thing a secret. In the process of building it, he told his girlfriend. And part of the reason was he didn't actually think that anyone was actually going to use this thing. He thought that maybe, you know, he would get a few hundred people or something like that. It could prove to be an experiment that he could, you know, explore as an idea to legalize drugs. He never imagined it would become as big as it did. And Julia, of course, as the site starts growing, continues to grow at this rapid pace, Julia starts to get really scared. And she's not working on the site, but she's terrified that she'll be caught up in it if he ever gets caught, because she lives with him and so on and so forth. And so he She eventually, they start fighting about it all the time. She keeps saying that people shouldn't be buying heroin on these sites and guns. And Ross's response is, well, it's not up to you. It's not up to the government. It's up to them what they put in their body. And she eventually goes to New York to kind of escape everything. And when she's there, she tells a friend. And the friend eventually posts something on Ross's website, on Ross's Facebook page, saying, you know, after an argument, saying, you know, wouldn't the government love to know about your secret drug website? And that is one of the events that, you know, Ross immediately deletes it off Facebook, but it's one of the events that sets Ross on this path to kind of start traveling around the world while he works on the site in secret locations. And he eventually goes to Australia and Thailand and all over Asia, and then out to Costa Rica, and eventually ends up in San Francisco, where he spent the last year of his free life working on the Silk Road.
Was it always a solo operation? He did have to bring other people in eventually, didn't he?
He brought other people in pretty quickly. He found people that were using the site that were programmers that volunteered to help, and they, you know, just like any other business, it was difficult to run it. He really kind of ran it in the same way that most people run tech websites. He had employees. He had essentially Variety Jones became his kind of consigliere, his COO. He was like the Sheryl Sandberg of Facebook to the Silk Road. He had people who ran the forums and supervisors. People had to clock in and clock out, and they had to write up a synopsis of what they'd done that day. You know, it was a real business, and he ran it very, very well. You know, he had different problems than a real business would have. For example, you know, he would have hackers that would take the site offline so it wouldn't work, and they would demand a ransom of up to $50,000 to $100,000 to bring it back online. And eventually, you know, Ross started paying it because he had so much money at his disposal. And then the other thing that started to happen was there's a moment where he is being chased by, you know, all these law enforcement officers, and one of his employees gets arrested in a cocaine deal gone awry. And he orders, he decides to hire a hitman to kill the guy. What he doesn't know is that he hired a hitman who is actually a DEA agent. And what he also doesn't know is that the DEA agent ends up stealing money in the process of performing this fake murder with another Secret Service agent. And when you kind of get to that part of the story, it just becomes so unbelievable that all this stuff happened. But it's all true.
So, I mean, what kinds of questions can we know that Ross might have asked himself at this point? It's like, how important is this to me that I'm now talking about getting people killed to continue this thing that I think is good for the world because it's free?
I think for Ross, it was really, you know, he got to a point where he truly did believe that the site was going to be so large that it would end up proving to the world that legalizing drugs would make the world a safer place. He really truly believed that, and he reciprocated that to his employees and friends on the site and numerous times. And he believed that it would become so big, the website, and so many people would use it, that he would be able to kind of unmask himself as the Dread Pirate Roberts, which was pretty naive. I mean, I think the site was doing a tremendous amount of business, but it was never going to eclipse the illegal version of buying and selling drugs. But he, when it came to the murders, I think that he thought that he was going to be, you know, in the same way that Steve Jobs was willing to allow certain people to die while making iPhones because of the strenuous workload, or there are instances where, you know, bad things happen as a result of other businesses. I think that Ross saw, you know, the murder of one employee in order to save the website was just a task that he had to take, and that was partially what he had to, the responsibility of someone who was running the site.
A sacrifice for a greater cause, or something along those lines.
Yeah.
So when you talked about the different people involved here, Carl Force in Baltimore, we haven't mentioned him by name yet. We talked about Jared in Chicago. I mean, were these guys talking to each other, or was it another case where you got a different federal law enforcement agencies starting investigations without talking about it to other federal law enforcement agencies?
Yeah, I mean, so they were all talking to each other, but they weren't communicating. So they're all kind of competing in many respects. You've got the Jared Geagan, who is kind of working his own case, and you have this Baltimore team, which includes Carl Force, the DEA agent that is running their case, and they're not communicating with Chicago. And then you've got the New York DEA that's not really doing anything because they don't have any computer help or computer background. Then you have the FBI that gets involved, and once the FBI gets involved, everyone else is terrified because the FBI is, of course, they specialize in cybercrime, and it's the cybercrime team that is running it. This guy Chris Tarbell, and so you've just got all these agents from all over the place, and they're not communicating. It eventually gets so bad that the Department of Justice, which oversees all of this stuff and decides who gets prosecuted and so on, they hold what's called a deconfliction meeting, and the deconfliction meeting is in Washington in the secret location one day. And you also have a guy from the IRS, Gary Alford, who's a lot of people's favorite character because he's got these weird quirks where he like reads everything three times and so on. you get these people together and they all start, you know, communicating with what they have and what they haven't. And the Baltimore team of agents refuses to share anything, and the Department of Justice gets really upset. And so, you know, but eventually at this point, this is mid-2013, because the agents come together, some of them start working together. So DeYeagan and the FBI agents start working together. And through a series of events, they start to figure out who the guy is that's running the site, and that it's Ross Ulbricht.
How could they even be sure at first that they were dealing with an American site or American creators, given the way that things are?
Oh, they didn't. They didn't think they were. They thought that it was. At first they thought it was the Mexican cartel, and they figured maybe it was a group of drug dealers in the Bronx that had hired a programmer. Maybe, you know, at first they thought it was a guy from Google because he had these strong libertarian beliefs and was very open about legalizing drugs. There was a belief that it was this guy Mark Karpeles who ran a Bitcoin website. You know, it was just one after the other of beliefs, and they. They continue to go down these different routes. Eventually, when they put all these clues together, which pointed to Ross, at first they didn't actually think it was him. They thought this is crazy. You know, how can they looked at his Facebook page and here was this sweet kid from Austin, Texas, who was once a Boy Scout, you know, kissing his mother on the cheek and you know, posing for family dinners and so on. But then once they started to read the things that the real Ross Ulbricht had posted on Facebook and on online, on LinkedIn, on YouTube, it was all the same kind of philosophies arguing about libertarian beliefs and legalizing drugs and the government not being involved in people's lives. And a few other clues started to pile on top of one another. And eventually the FBI started to trail Ross and they would see that every single time the Dread Pirate Roberts would log off, Ross would close his laptop, and every time he would log on, Ross would open his laptop, and all these clues started to pile atop each other until they definitely knew they had their guy.
As the Silk Road became Ross's life, was there anybody who was still in touch with the real world enough to be able to just look him in the eye and say, dude, you really have turned into El Chapo on the internet?
You know, no. The problem was that there was no one telling him what he had done was good or bad or you know, or otherwise. He's literally living in this world where he's the only person that's running it. He's none of his friends have any idea what he's doing, and he is he loses touch with reality for the most part. You know, he really just. There's no one that he has all these devils on his shoulder, but no angels to tell him maybe you shouldn't do that. And And you see him, you know, completely lose touch. He doesn't just order the hit of one person. He thinks he's ordering the hit of five other people too, for stealing things, money and things from the website. And he also kind of doesn't understand that people, there are kids that are ordering drugs from the site, teenagers. There's a story in the book about a teenager who overdoses and dies in Perth. There are other people. And he sees that people are using the site. And there's two sides of the story. There's the side that he sees people are using the site, and they are, there are studies that have been done since the site that have shown that people prefer buying drugs online because they feel safer and they don't worry about being arrested and they don't worry about being killed or attacked by drug dealers gone awry. And so he succeeded in that respect. But at the same time, he also failed in the fact that the Silk Road enabled people to buy, you know, things like fentanyl from these labs in China, which is, you know, 50 to 100 times stronger than traditional heroin, and lots of overdoses, that kids could get their hands on things and they didn't know what they had and how much to take. Because of the complete lack of regulation, that there were repercussions to that side of it too. And there were overdoses and arrests and lots of bad things that took place.
Just about a minute left. Does Ross Ulbricht to this day, does he think he's a criminal mastermind?
I think Ross believes, you know, I it's interesting. One of the questions I'm asked is about Ross is what he thinks about his creation today. He did say he regretted at one point in court. He had regrets, but I think that he probably regrets more that he got caught.
Huh. All right. Well, it's a long trail that leads to him finally getting caught. It's a fascinating tale, well told by Nick Bilton in the book American Kingpin, The Epic Hunt for the Criminal Mastermind Behind the Silk Road. Nick, thanks for writing it. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.